You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Episode 11, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome, I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. This is The Paradox, if you're here for a first time. Thank you so much for joining me. I think you'll learn some interesting things today. Also, I encourage you to go back and listen to some past episodes, always new topics on medicine. And thank you, friend, who sent this podcast your way. Or if you just stumbled upon it, it's your good fortune and mine as well. If you're a returning listener, thank you so much again for coming back and then also for sharing the show with your friends and colleagues and family. If you're a physician, this is a great way to share the show with your friends and people who are maybe medically oriented or interested in what's going on. It's a great way of showing them what's going on in the trenches of medicine. Without getting too technical, I expect that physicians will learn things, but also people, lay people and people who are associated in the healthcare field, which are not physicians, for instance, nurses and other personnel. As always, go to the Patreon page at patreon.com/theparadox. That's paradox spelled with a D-O-C-S. There you can sign up to be a patron supporter of the show. Every dollar raised goes towards the production and promotion of the show. You'll have access to bonus content as I produce more of it. I'll have my advertisement, which is running in Phoenix, Arizona, thanks to my cousin. And I'd also encourage you to visit the website at theparadox.com, where you can find show notes and obviously links to things that we talk about during the show. But also you can sign up for the email list. There's also now a YouTube channel. I am also on Facebook and Twitter, so there's no excuse for seeing my face and finding out more of the show and ways of spreading the show. Today's episode's an interesting one. I apologize a little bit in advance for the audio. It gets a little crackly, just a teeny bit partway through the show and actually just kind of various portions. I'm just returning back from a great vacation fishing in Canada with my boys. That was a great Father's Day weekend, so I hope you had a nice Father's Day as well. I would recommend the Watson's Windy Point Lodge, and I'll actually put their link on my show notes page. They did a great job, and if you want great walleye and northern fishing, you can't beat the place. Very personal, very nice people, and it's a great experience for a family. We always have fun to go there every couple of years or so. I'd like to talk about the show now. Dr. Michelle Akkad is a cardiologist and internist out in California. He wrote a very interesting book called Moving Mountains, and I apologize again in the show that it takes me probably about a good 5 to 10 minutes to really kind of get it. And I don't know, the hamster is not running quite as fast in the cage of my mind, but it took a little bit to kind of figure out the essence and the point of it. So today's almost a philosophical discussion of medicine, and much of medicine now, and certainly through medical training, is based on evidence-based medicine. And that means you use best practices and not an algorithmic, but oftentimes an algorithmic approach to medicine, because the focus and the emphasis on much of education is on the population, right? So you want to keep people in general healthy. But the focus is not oftentimes on the person healthy. It seems a contradiction. However, it does come into play oftentimes when you're practicing. And if you're a physician, you know exactly what I mean. But how it actually affects your decision-making and what that means for a specific patient, well, that's sort of what we get into during the show, and so I think you'll find it interesting, different. I do think that when you look at individuals as opposed to patients as a population, it does shift the way you approach them, and it's something that certainly seems has always made me feel uneasy, I guess, while I'm practicing. I don't find I have as much problems with this as maybe a generalist. A family practice or internist or pediatrician, just because I have more of a technical sort of practice. It's sort of like if you did heart catheterizations, for the most part, you're just doing the catheterization, finding where the blockage and fixing it. I mean, there are obviously ways you can individualize treatment, but essentially you're more of a technician. But many physicians are more practicing medicine, and that's why we call it practicing, and there's the art of medicine. And I think we get into, without using the word art, I think there's certainly the art and sort of the essence and the wisdom that comes along with practicing medicine is something that is de-emphasized in today's healthcare system. But I think it's essential for patients, and I think it's what patients prefer in some way, although they may not think about it that way, nor do the physicians. But I think it's a different way of looking at how we treat people. And so anyway, without further delay, I'd like to go ahead and get into the episode. Again, this is episode 11 with Dr. Michel Akkad on his book, The Moving Mountains. Enjoy. Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. I'm here joined by my new friend, Dr. Michel Akkad, who is a practicing cardiologist and internist out in California. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And today's going to be a real interesting interview. As I was talking just before we went on, I really don't know where this is going to go, because a lot of what we're going to talk about today is, I suppose it's an unorthodox approach to medicine. And I would say that your book, which I found very interesting, was an unorthodox book about an unorthodox subject. And I think the basic premise is you had Dr. Jeffrey Rose, who I certainly had never heard of him before. And he was from, mainly his work was in the 1960s that he sort of began his, with most of his impact?
A little bit, correct. That's right. 1960s. He himself wrote his own book in 1993. So his career spanned maybe 40 years from the late 50s to the early 1990s. And then he died shortly after publishing
right.
his book.
And so the book is a conversation between Socrates, who has been long gone in this world for a couple thousand years, right? And this Dr. Jeffrey Rose, and it's a discussion on Rose's, I don't know if you'd say philosophy, but sort of his approach to medicine. And he was, I gather, more of an epidemiologist, where he's looking at populations versus individual patients. Is that pretty accurate?
That's right. I mean, nowadays, I think you can't really open a medical journal or even the lay magazines without hearing about the concept of population health. It's population health this, population health that. Everybody's in favor of population health, and of course, you know, who's going to be against population health? But the term has actually a specific meaning. And you can trace it back to the theory of Jeffrey Rose, who was an epidemiologist. He was a clinician. I don't know if he was a cardiologist or not, but I know that his early work was in cardiovascular disease epidemiology. He was part of fairly large and important studies in the 60s and 70s. And but then he elaborated a certain theory about health and disease, which eventually culminated into a movement. And the movement has taken over academia and has, you know, caught the interest of a lot of people, including, you know, sort of private large health systems. Everybody espouses the idea of population health, although nobody is really sure what it means. And so part of my book was to try to get to the bottom of that.
Right. And so your book called Moving Mountains, again, real interesting. And that'll be up on the show notes page, which is theparadox.com/011. And I guess when you look at the book, it starts out by just addressing, I guess, the way we look at medicine. And so right now, when you treat someone, I always joke again, and this is the same thing I said in the last episode, but, you know, when you talk about a medication and how well it works, it essentially works at either 0% or 100% for most people, right? Sort of like your chance of getting cancer is 0 or 100%. I don't know which it is. Right? You're either going to get it or not. I can give you averages. And so most of medicine, and certainly with my medical training, I graduated from medical school in 2000 and finished, and I went out of private practice in 2004. And so when you look at how effective medications are or the chance of things happening, I would say you translate things that are population based, I guess you'd say, to the individual, and I guess the question is, are you are you looking at a different way of approaching patients from like an individual medication or something like that? Because, you know, I'll say you have a 20% chance of getting a sore throat from my breathing tube when I, you know, I'll take it out for a day or so. Is that not the way you approach it, or are we talking about something entirely different?
No, I think that's part of the problem. I mean, are you asking me what I do myself in clinical practice?
Well, not you specifically, I guess. I guess the question is the way that we learn things now in medicine, and the way, you know, journals report that the treatment X is 40% effective or whatever, you know, saying, is that different than what it was? And then how would medicine be? Why don't you just answer the first thing? Is it different than it used to be? Did medicine have a different approach and way of looking at
it? Yes, I think it does. I mean, I think right now this emphasis on quantifying probabilities and risks and degrees of belief and so forth is all very new. I'm saying in a relative sense. I mean, it's a 20th century thing, and pretty much a post-World War II thing, where all of a sudden statistical inference became extremely important and dominates everything, not just in medicine, but in many other fields of the social sciences and so forth. So now right. We talk about things, you know, you would tell a patient, and without batting an eyelash, you will tell the patient you have a 20% chance of getting this or that.
Yeah, right.
But if you think about it, it's kind of an incoherent, you know, statement, because either it's going to happen or it's not going to happen. It's either true or false. And this precise quantification did not come to us naturally. It built in over the last few decades by the encroachment primarily of you know, public health considerations and the applied statistics that were essentially brought into the clinical and the bedside and the clinical arena. So, you know, it's not actually the focus of my book, but it's an important aspect, and so we can spend a few minutes talking about it. So there is a sense in which, you know, we seem to have various degrees of certainty about what will happen.
Right.
Right, but it's a far cry from actually putting a number to it, okay. and saying it's, you know, 20% or X percent, and even that degree of certainty, you know, philosophically, if you dig into it, it's complicated exactly what that means. So I don't want to spend too much time on that, but there is certainly, there's been a huge push to have doctors embrace this, you know, this whole quantification thing and make calculations on the basis of percentages of, you know, what we expect will happen and so forth. Go ahead.
Would you say that's more a cultural societal shift in that people are, I don't know if they're more educated or they just feel like you want to quantify the risk so that people have an expectation for what's going to happen, right? So I'm going to operate on your leg and I'm going to tell you, you have a very good chance that you'll have pain afterwards. And I'll say, there's a chance you get an infection. They say, well, I'm going to infection in my leg. I might have to have my leg amputated. Well, that's a very small chance. And then you feel some need to quantify that in some way to say, well, it's extremely rare, but I have to tell you about all the risks. Is that sort of what you're.
Yes. So you're right. There's a huge cultural shift and it's very deep. It's very deep because philosophically it has to do with how we think about what we know, and, you know, it's about the theory of knowledge, if you will. And now we seem to be reduced to thinking of knowledge in terms of you know, some kind of mathematical probability function. But in reality, it should be that. The surgeon is going to operate because he thinks or she thinks it's the right thing to do, right? At this moment in time, you know, I'm the surgeon and I think it's the right thing to do. And either the patient agrees or doesn't, you know, or disagrees. But really, there's no reason for mathematics to enter into into the equation, if I can make that pun here.
Right.
So there is this sort of cultural emphasis on methods of quantification, and they have pervaded our thinking very deeply, so that now when I point out that it's a little bit ludicrous to think in terms of probability and statistics and how you apply the results of clinical trials and all that stuff, I get a lot of blank stares from my audience because they can't imagine not thinking without, some kind of handle on, what clinical trials show, what percentage of patients, what percentage of patients do what and so forth.
Right. And so, and I would say in looking at medicine now and sort of the way it's practiced and the way it's evolving, and I think it's just, I've noticed a change since I've been out in practice now for almost 14, 15 years, that there's a more of an algorithm sort of based method. And I know you get into this in the book. And so I think that sort of goes along with the numbers, right? So you say, well, I know that 20% of people, if I look at a large population, we're going to have going to get an infection when they have a urinary catheter, and let's say, or whatever, let's say it's 20%. So I think, well, if I want to minimize my risk for that, I'm going to standardize a process where I don't place them because then I'm going to decrease my risks for this. And so that may not actually be the best treatment for that particular patient, but on a population wide, that from a hospital system standpoint or, a healthcare system, that it's going to be better for them from a number standpoint, even though maybe that one particular patient would benefit from having that because they can't get up to the bathroom and so they're more likely to fall or whatever, but you sort of reduce an individualized statistic where, yes, if you look at everybody, there's a 20% chance of infection, but that person, maybe it's very small and the risk for everything else is so much greater, but because you have a certain protocol in place.
Correct. I think you're right. I mean, essentially it's the tension between, what is fundamentally clinical judgment, because clinical judgment is about a specific person at a given point in time under very specific circumstances. And there's really no way to, or the population studies should be secondary and shouldn't dictate what you're going to do for that person or what you're going to recommend to that person at any given point in time. They inform your judgment, the large studies inform your judgment, but I think people are mistaken in how the large studies actually inform judgment. For example, if there's a clinical trial, that has enrolled, thousands of patients, I think the important information from the clinical trial is nothing more than the shared experience. So you can read the clinical trial report and have, get a sense of, in general, what happens to people when they're exposed to this treatment or this diagnostic test and whatnot. But the actual outcome of the trial, whether, you can say that the drug was more effective or ineffective with a p-value of 0.0 whatever, all this quantification is actually irrelevant. Because you have, if say drug A is superior to drug B by, 12% points, 12 percentage and whatnot, that doesn't tell you what's going to happen to your patient, whether you give your patient drug A or drug B. It's almost irrelevant. But there's information that's full in terms of, it's essentially shared experience. And in a way, it's not really different from what people did before clinical trials were so popular. They would just publish large case series. And, they would not be, the case series would not have precise concomitant control groups and whatnot. They would have historical controls and so forth. But they were useful nevertheless. And you can, in a way, mentally fill in the blanks. And that's what wise clinicians would be, are able to do. They can sort of mentally make, imagine what might happen to the patient with one process or another, and then make a decision. And it doesn't. And at the end of the day, you never know if any particular decision is the right thing for the patient or not, because you don't have a parallel universe to compare it to. Right? To compare what you do. So whether you follow the currently preferred population-based algorithms to the T, or whether you right. use your own clinical judgment and whatever reasoning you come up with based on your experience and your whatever wisdom you have, and people have different degrees of wisdom. You know, there's no way to say that one is superior, you know, scientifically or quantify that one approach is better than the other. But the difference is that the algorithm is in many ways inhumane. And, right. and we sense that. We have a strong sense of, I think, clinicians who try to pay attention to their patients, you know, get a sense that they can come up with reasons to deviate from the, I mean, not always. I mean, sometimes you're going to follow the algorithm, but other times you want to be able to deviate from the algorithm. And you may not always be able to articulate it. So the problem now is that there's a demand, a constant demand on clinicians to articulate precisely, you know, why they're taking each right. step that they're taking. And that, you know, it takes a huge amount of time and it's distracting and it's, and so the path of...
Well, it's not accurate.
And it's not right? accurate. Correct. Right. Right.
I mean, so essentially you're... So what you're doing is you're taking these large studies that are over large populations and they have these... And you're trying to hope that your patient matches the average patient of the 1,000 people or so, or 10,000 that might be in this large study. And you're hoping that the circumstances are similar and that you can extrapolate using that study, appropriate treatment. And of course, you can't make any assurances because it turns out that people are very different.
Correct.
And I think, and I've been to a lot of, and this is very important because I've been to a lot of meetings in the hospitals and certainly all through medical school. I mean, you know, evidence-based medicine, at least when I was in training, that was the gold standard, right? We want to practice evidence-based medicine because we don't want to just kind of use random sort of guesses. We want to have an educated, systematic approach to treatment, and that's using these studies that match your population, that your individual matches some population, right, for a particular procedure or whether, you know, disease. And so you essentially have you're essentially extrapolating and you're guessing. But the problem is that again, no one's the same, and I've heard at least 3 or 4 Six Sigma talks in the healthcare system and in other talks like in the large specialty forums where they talk about bringing airline pilots to try and streamline, make the hospitals work appropriately. And then, you know, they talk, these pilots come in, they're aghast at how we go, they walk into an operating room and everyone uses different instruments and people use different approaches for doing whatever. Maybe it's like putting a knee or they use different instrument systems. And everyone has a different way of doing the anesthesia. And the nurses may do things a little bit differently as well. And so they can't believe that we have essentially 1,000 different ways of doing the same thing, right? And so and for someone who runs who's a pilot of a plane, you get in that 747, everything's exactly in the same place. All the parts are where they are in every other 747, you know, made by Boeing. And so you're into your flight checks exactly the same. And so you should go through, I mean, algorithm absolutely makes sense. Or if you're in a car factory, everything should be in the same place and everything runs exactly the same because every car is going to come out exactly the same, maybe just a different color or something like that. And so the healthcare systems, and this is not unique to any healthcare system that I'm aware of, they're all the same in the sense that they try and use that same process to move patients through. And I find it amazing that people they're entirely capable of looking across the room and not being surprised that no one looks like them. They're different shapes and sizes and ages. And, you know, some people have canes or whatever. And yet they are somehow feel that they can use the same principles of automation with a mass producing, you know, toasters and use that sort of thing to take care of people and treat their illness. I mean,
That's right. That's right. So the airplane analogy, you know, has had a lot of purchase among, you know, healthcare policy planners and so forth. To be fair, it's not entirely unreasonable. And there may be parts of, you know, the process of healthcare that can lend themselves to you know, a sort of a more mechanical and regimented and algorithmic approach.
Oh, absolutely. Hearts are, yes.
So it's not entirely unreasonable. But the question is, who should design the algorithms? When should they be applied? When should they be? Should there be exceptions to the algorithms? How frequently should they be modified? And the problem is that, for the most part, it's been a top-down approach where the people who are best able to design the algorithms and implement them where they should be implemented are rarely part of the decision process, and the algorithms are imposed from from the outside and top down, and it's going to be the same algorithm for the entire country, and the goals of implementation of the algorithms, you know, there are conflicts of interest because it's tied to how much a hospital will get paid and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of problems with that. But it's not that, you know, we're completely against algorithms all the time, but it's, you know, what algorithms, when, and who should decide. And we're in a healthcare system where everything is extremely centralized, where there's a fragmentation and of interest and conflict of interest, and it's all discombobulated, impose algorithms seems to the central planner a way to put order into the mess, but it really doesn't. It just adds to the confusion in many ways.
Right, and I think if you're a hospital administrator, you're looking at ways of trying to get a handle on how much things cost and how to move and a throughput and inventory. And I mean, there, many parts of healthcare, as you say, are definitely useful to use algorithms. For instance, I'm in the operating theater. So for me, it makes sense to have a process for cleaning the room and turning over between operations. You have someone come in who mops, someone who comes in who wipes down all the cables, someone who makes sure all the medications are the right place, someone brings new case carts in, take the old case carts out, and gets all that stuff set up. I mean, that is it can be easily regimented and automated sort of process. It's just when it comes to the patient who lays on the table, I guarantee that patient who lays on the table is nothing like the patient before. I mean, they probably have four limbs, but outside that, it could be entirely different.
Right.
And so you can't expect to have that process be the same, right? You wouldn't come in if you bring in a Toyota and you change the oil and the next car that comes in is like a Tesla. Well, it doesn't even have oil, right? I mean, you can't treat it the same way. And so the expectation that things are the same is inappropriate in that sense. However, there are parts that the algorithm works.
And you want the clinicians and the healthcare workers who are closest to the patient, you want them to be able to decide and not be so preoccupied at following the algorithms, because there's been so much emphasis on following the algorithm that it's become a huge distraction, and it's become the primary focus of many doctors and healthcare workers. It's just, you know, following the routine because, you know, somebody's watching and the quality standards are going to be reflected on whether you check all the boxes and do things in a very algorithmic way and so forth. But the whole thing fundamentally, the fundamental problem is that in our healthcare system and in all healthcare, you know, large Western healthcare systems, it's been the case for the last 50, 60 years, 70 years, that the patient is, I mean, to me, it's an economic problem or a socioeconomic problem, is that paying for healthcare, you know, the financing of the healthcare system is done by third parties, whether it's the government or large insurance companies that are in many ways sponsored by government programs and or subsidized and so forth. So you have this situation where you have the clinicians, the hospitals being paid for by an entity that is not ultimately the patient, or that is not ultimately the person receiving the care. And so there's an inherent conflict of interest. And this population-based management system that includes algorithms, it includes guidelines, it includes all the things, you know, things that I talk about in the book, is the natural consequence of this arrangement of third parties paying for the care of the population at large and wanting to manage how the system is run. And so that's the reason why. And until that changes, I don't think you're able to correct that because, you know, if now we care is is financed primarily, say, by insurance companies or primarily by the government or whatnot, it stands to reason that the insurance company and the government want to have a say in how the money is being spent. But the problem is that they are not doctors and they're not there at the time that the care is being given. They can't have a spy in each operating room or a representative in every examination room in the doctor's office. And therefore, the only way they can, get a handle on the situation is to impose, algorithms and impose, population-based philosophies on how care should be dispersed. And that's what we see.
Right. And so, I mean, to the first part of your point, when you talk about checking, clicking boxes, that absolutely is synonymous with an electronic health record, right? So you have these records in it. And so the way to try and make sure everything's been done properly and to document it is you have to have some sort of algorithm so that you actually complete the different tasks that are involved. So the electronic health record is in many ways is almost forcing algorithms or algorithmic approach to medicine in a non-individualized treatment pattern. And then your point about the third party payers essentially is that if I have a house and if I'm the government, let's just say, and I want to make sure the houses don't burn down, I want to make sure I get the small percentage of houses burned down. So I centralize my fire station by where the largest population is, right? But if you live way out of the country, I'm not as worried about you because you're only one house. And although for you, that is everything, right? And so you'd want to make sure that you absolutely have fire coverage and your houses are burned down. So your incentive is not going to match and align with the government's the third party, the person paying for it, because they want it. They're looking at the population as a whole, and so they're minimizing their overall fire risk. And if you're way on the end, well, you're just kind of out of luck because you're a small percentage of, right? And so that's sort of the way of looking
at it. That's right. And that's really in the best case scenario, because to say that they're interested in the population as a whole, perhaps gives them a little too much credit. I mean, for the most part, politicians are interested in getting reelected. That's their primary interest. Bureaucrats are interested in keeping their job and not having their agency be in the newspaper one day because there's some kind of a scandal or something. And so they're going to be extremely conservative and just do what they've been doing for the last 20 years. And plus they have no knowledge of what happens on the scene. And so they apply these statistical methods and this utilitarian calculus, but it really doesn't work. I mean, even if they can, do some kind of study to give them a rough guide as to what would optimize outcomes in a certain way, the nature of medicine and medical care and healthcare is so dynamic intrinsically that, by the time they apply the guidelines derived from these studies, things have changed and you have no confidence in the fact that even if the guidelines and the algorithms were applied perfectly, that would actually maximize anything, and it probably wouldn't, I think everybody knows that, but nobody's willing to admit it.
Well, and you've seen this when it comes to beta blockade, and for a while everyone they're using beta blockers, which is a medication that's used to slow the heart rate and is found to have a protective effect on the heart. And so their large studies were placed, and they showed that there was a benefit to people who to stay in beta blockers. And so then what happened is people extrapolated and said, well, everybody should be in beta blockers before surgery. So they started piling all these beta blockers on these different people, these medications, and then they find out later on that, of course, this causes increased incidence of stroke and other problems. And what's more interesting, of course, is that after about 5 or 6 years of people knowing this, the government and the, I don't know if it's CMS, but all the different healthcare systems, they all, and insurance companies, that one of their markers for quality was that you make sure people are on beta blockers.
Right. Right? And right.
Then, but then by the time they have imposed, it's been imposed for maybe just a couple of years, and they're starting to reward or penalize healthcare systems for having high or low numbers of people on beta blockers. Then they discover that it's disadvantageous to be on them, and it takes them years to get it off, right? And so they,
yes.
And so you, like to your point, the dynamism of sort of healthcare and the new medications techniques.
And not only that, but then they don't even suffer they're not themselves penalized for imposed right. the wrong policy that has hurt possibly countless hapless patients, doctors. They suffer no consequence and they keep doing what they've been doing all along. They'll try something else, with equally low probability of really being on target with anything.
Yeah, you're not going to switch to a different CMS, right? You're kind of there's only one Center for right. Medicare Services, and so this kind of goes into the. I guess so this is the philosophical question now. If you are maybe not philosophical is the wrong word, but so if I'm treating a patient. And I want to use an approach different than what's used now. So would it be sort of like me going to the car to get my car fixed and going to the mechanic and he said, well, it's about a 40% chance this carburetor is going to get you fixed. And, there's a good chance this car's, but, it's maybe about a 75% chance this thing's going to run okay for the next, 6 months. Versus going and just saying, we think this is wrong. This needs to be fixed. I've looked over the car. Because no one ever gets percentages in anything else. I mean, you don't go to get a cake made and they say, well, it's about an 85% chance for right. the icing right. And I think our lettering will be good. Our spelling's really good. So about a 98% chance of spelling being proper. I mean,
Right. And what's the risk of eating too much sugar? Right. Right. Yeah, the sugar to the family.
Chance of too much sugar, 100%. So there aren't many parts of life where actually, I mean, in reading your book, and not until I sort of talking about now, does it sort of make sense to me that your point really is that there aren't many places in life where you are almost expect to have these sorts of probabilities tossed around, except partly the nature of how healthcare is paid for and delivered, and because you have very large impersonal organizations that are looking over you.
So yes, Eric, the key word is impersonal because in this system where you have third parties involved, whether it's the payers or the regulators or the government or whatnot, and all these third parties view things on a population or from a population perspective, and they don't really care individually about any given patient or any specific patient, this arrangement here changes the nature of the medical relationship, because the medical relationship really ultimately is about a doctor caring for and caring about another individual person,
right?
And therefore the decision, when you as a doctor you make a decision, it's you think that for patient X, or Mrs. Jones or Mr. Brown in front of you, that's going to be in his or her best interest. Okay. And that has been distorted. Right. And now what happens now, we're training and we're being trained, and that includes me and you and, people who have been in practice for the last 30, 40 years, or probably even more in my opinion. I mean, that's been sort of ongoing for a long time. We've turned the doctor into a sort of an expert technician. So now there's a detachment from the patient, and you're the expert, and you're going to apply the wizardry of statistical probabilities and prognostication and so forth in order to make a decision. But that's really contrary to the nature of what medicine is about. And people are confused, I think, about that. And well-meaning people are confused. And people who go into medicine for the right reason, thinking that it's going to be a profession really about personal relationship, end up discovering that it's become a technical profession about applying these algorithms and these population-based considerations. to patients in a very impersonal level. Now, of course, many people try to do the best that they can and intuitively still hang on to the correct notion of what medicine is about. But there's clearly a conflict. It puts everybody in a conflict.
Right. And you hear, and so, I mean, part of the nature, I imagine, is because you have people with less technical skills that they're trying to deliver healthcare, right? I mean, I think this comes to the
right.
To the
mid-level, that's right. That's right.
And I mean, I don't want to get into that too much, but I feel when it comes to, I certainly I've talked to a number of physicians. We'll talk about this in just a moment, but I've talked to some direct primary care physicians, and they're the ones who were in previous healthcare systems. They definitely have that assembly line, a mill sort of feel to it, that they're judged on the referral rates, how much they utilize imaging, and they utilize laboratories and referrals within the healthcare system's network, and that they're not judged on how well their patients do, because it's more on how they utilize resources, or there are a lot of other things pulling them in different directions that are not in the interest of the patient. I mean, they may not necessarily be against the patient's wishes or like detrimental to them, but certainly that they have a lot of other things pulling them besides that person sitting in front of them. And that's not why many of us got into medicine to begin with, right? It's that Norman Rockwell painting.
Correct. And you're right that people will make the claim that, you know, I mean, you have to standardize because, you know, there were lots of doctors who were not technically proficient before. But the truth is that technical proficiency can never be a good substitute for genuinely caring doctors. And right. And the doctors who are genuinely caring will actually go ahead and gain the technical proficiency and implement the algorithm when they see that it's the right thing to do, and, you know, maintain good records when they see that it's the right thing to do. You know, my favorite example, and it goes way back, but my favorite example is the example of the Mayo Clinic. I've studied the early history of the Mayo Clinic, and believe it or not, the founder of the Mayo Clinic, the you know, didn't have any license to speak of, you know, whether it's the father Mayo or his two sons, the brothers Mayo. But they were, you know, they were motivated by the care for their patients and the care for the profession. And therefore, they went to school. They got all the degrees that were necessary. They kept up to date. They implemented the medical record. Really, the modern medical record was invented at the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic had all kinds of processes, sort of regimented processes so as to run smoothly, right? But these were not imposed from the outside by third-party regulators. They were designed by the doctors who cared, who, you know, saw what the best way of running things was. They implemented it accordingly. And they were rewarded by the patients. The patients could recognize that this was the better care. And they got rewarded, and the Mayo Clinic became very, very successful before there was any kind of third-party intervention to, quote-unquote, ensure that everybody's, you know, competent. And with this illusion that you can ensure the competency of doctors by imposing technical proficiency exams, whether it's, you know, board certifications or whatnot, or that you can and when that fails, then you resort to algorithms. And when that fails, you resort to, I don't know what you resort. You resort to replacing doctors with you know, robots or non-doctors who are more willing or more malleable and more willing to follow algorithms. And that's the trend. That's the trend that I'm seeing, is that there's a to some extent. I mean, there's an awakening right now among doctors and a healthy rebellion against all of that, but we need to be very vigilant, because that's the logic of the system, the logic of the central planners and the third party payers and the regulators, is that they only see processes, and they only focus on the a certain idea of population health, and it's very unhealthy. As I say, population health is very unhealthy.
So how would you counter someone who says to you, well, that's all. I mean, I understand you want to treat people as individuals, and, you know, you do your best you can within a system. But how do you square the fact that people need screening, right? So how do you figure out who you recommend to have colonoscopies and PSAs and mammograms? How do you decide on that sort of thing if you are treating not populations, but you're just treating individuals? How would you counter that argument?
Right. So it doesn't discount, you treat individuals, but you don't discount the value of population-based studies. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't do population-based studies and learn from those studies. But the focus should not be the population, the health of the population. The focus should always be the health of the individual. And it's interesting that right now we live in an age where we can't think of doing population health studies without having big government programs and whatnot. But something that people don't really know is that hypertension, the idea that high blood pressure is bad for you, was discovered not by academic running large public health or epidemiologic studies. It was actually discovered by the private sector. It was discovered by life insurance companies in the 1920s and 1930s. And in those days, people, you know, doctors knew very little about blood pressure. The devices to measure the blood pressure accurately had just been, you know, designed and invented, but there was no application for them, and therefore the doctors were really not interested in measuring anybody's blood pressure. But the insurance companies got wind of that and thought, they started to wonder if having a high blood pressure, you know, had any significance for the future. So they enrolled doctors and they taught them how to measure the blood pressure. They gave them blood pressure, you know, manometers, and they are the ones who collected the data privately that determines that yes, having a high pressure at baseline, you know, gives you a higher chance of having poor outcomes in the future, and so all that was done sort of organically, and then the medical community embraced that knowledge and applied it. And we're not discounting the value of population studies, but what we want to refrain from getting into is changing our focus from the patient in front of us, the patient to whom we should be or about whom we should be caring and for whom we should be caring, and to substitute for that individual attention the attention to the broader population.
Right.
Which is never productive. It's always counterproductive. You know, if you take care of every individual, the population will become healthy. But the converse is not true. And the converse is what they, you know, the people who push the population health agendas want you to believe. They say, no. They, you know, work on these population-based norms, and then your patients will become healthy. But that doesn't make sense. And it's flatly false.
Yeah. And so you worked for, we're not going to talk about any specific healthcare system, but you worked for a large healthcare system at some point. And then I've had a couple direct primary care physicians, and I found your story a little bit more unusual in that you are a specialist. And so I talked to one of the physicians. He said it should be called direct patient care, not direct primary care, because he believes that we are moving towards a system with more of a sort of, I guess, a normal transaction within a market where you just have the patient pay you for whatever the services that they are requiring, whether it's a membership-based fee like for most of the direct primary care, or a one-time fee for someone who's a specialist you might only see once in your life or maybe on a rare occasion, right? So can you just briefly go into, I guess, how you ended up in direct primary care as a cardiologist and what that practice looks like as a specialist, and how, and then third part, how do you treat patients differently than you did before when you were within the large health system?
Right. Yeah. So I practice both. So I do. And the point that your friend was making is absolutely perfect. It should be direct patient care. And I call my cardiology practice direct cardiology care. And I call my primary care practice direct patient, you know, direct primary care. So, yes, that's right. And so I have a primary care practice that follows the DPC model, the direct primary care model. It's a reasonable monthly membership fee, and because the membership fee, it seems primary care seems to lend itself better to a membership model. And then I have a cardiology, an outpatient cardiology practice where people come and find me Right now, most of them find me, on their own online. I have a nice website. The practice is called the Athletic Heart of San Francisco. I try to make it sort of appealing and upbeat, as opposed to calling it, the Center for Cardiovascular Disease and Failure and whatnot.
You're dying. But please come see
right,
me.
You're, exactly. But what they find with me is that, number one, I'm readily available because I'm not congested. They don't have to wait 3 or 6 weeks to see me. They can see me usually within a few days for a cardiology consultation. I speak with them on the phone before they make an appointment, before they actually book an appointment, just to make sure that I understand their needs and that I can prepare the visit. After a brief phone call, if we decide to go ahead and have a visit, if I anticipate that they will need tests, then they will have their consultation and their non-invasive test in one fell swoop. And in a matter of 2 hours, they can leave my office with a diagnosis, the test done, the recommendations, and all of this, which otherwise would take them, weeks and weeks to obtain. And not only that, my cash fees tend to be extremely competitive for patients who have high deductible insurance. And so if they have a high deductible and they have the misfortune of going to the university hospital to get their ultrasound, it can be ruinous. Whereas here it's reasonable, and most of them find it very reasonable. And I tend to bundle my services into packages of commonly obtained tests, so that if they come and they have a consultation, an echo, an EKG, and a stress test, it's sort of bundled into one very affordable fee. And so people find that very advantageous, and they come even if they have insurance, because it's better than going within network.
Sure.
So my challenge is to market that, because you can't have, it's very expensive to have advertising campaigns and so forth when people only need a cardiologist rarely and punctually. So it takes a long time to ramp up the awareness of my practice.
Right.
But it's happening.
So how shocked are people when they talk to you that they're actually talking to a doctor who called
right.
who called them people are visiting
right.
a cardiologist? No
most
less.
Of them most of them are extremely grateful, and it immediately gives a sense of trust that the doctor is willing to talk to the patients before they even show up.
Do they believe it's really a doctor, or do they think it's a recording?
I think they do, because they've been on my website, and my website, I have a blog and a video and whatnot, so I'm very patient oriented in that way. And that, to answer your third question, I think that's the main difference, is that it's not that I'm smarter or a better clinician than those who practice in the system or within big box medicine, but I have the time, the freedom to focus my attention appropriately, and so I can do that. I don't have all of the distractions that my colleagues have of having to deal with paperwork to get paid, to justify the consultation, right. paperwork to show that you've provided quality care, notes that have all kinds of that are unreadable, really right. clinical notes that are unreadable because they contain so much garbage. And so I can do this. And then sometimes some patients, I can immediately dismiss them if I don't think they have a cardiac problem. I can tell them very quickly, right? I don't need to justify doing all kinds of stuff that's unnecessary. So if a patient needs a lot of attention, I can spend the time. And if they don't need a lot of attention, then I can tailor my consultation that way.
Right. And so how long have you been doing that?
It's been about 4 years.
Okay. So you're still solvent. So that's a good sign that it's working for
right.
you.
Right. Right. It's arduous. I mean, I don't want to minimize the difficulties.
Sure.
And so, but I would never trade this back to and clearly I'm not doing as financially it's absolutely a negative compared to what I was doing before, in the system.
From a financial standpoint.
Right. From a financial standpoint, it's a big, big loss, but it's a loss that I was willing to incur, in exchange for, peace of mind and sort of sanity and lack of burnout and that sort of thing.
Well, right. I mean, because there is a cost for you mentally, right, and spiritually, to have to do all that extra paperwork at the end of the day and to do things that you think are not helpful to your practice and certainly to your patients.
So.
And so there's a lot of busy work, right? And so there's a cost, and so you trade off extra pay you're kind of getting paid for doing stuff that was not helpful. It was harmful.
I think so. And I think it's, you know, it's reflected in this epidemic of physician burnout that we hear about and we experience either in ourselves or in our colleagues. I mean, I was kind of unhappy when I was, not particularly. I mean, I was paid well and I was doing fun stuff. I was doing a lot of cardiac procedures and so forth. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was always, triggered by, stuff that seemed to be out of my control that I wanted to do in a different way and that I couldn't. I felt helpless.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, we discussed in episode 8 where I discussed with Dr. Dierman, we talked about physician burnout and suicide and the threat of malpractice. And I was surprised to find the percentage of physicians who are contemplating suicide within any one year is 7%. And I found that really stunning. And, we have almost 400 physician suicides per year. And I won't say there's one thing that leads to this. It's probably, many things like everything. But, I think we undervalue sometimes personally what we have to deal with personally. So it's great that you found a spot that you're doing you're practicing the way you like to practice and that you think you're doing a good job. And that's probably worth a lot more than probably you even give yourself credit to for at times. Yeah. So again, the book is Moving Mountains, and that'll be linked on the show notes page. And are there any other ways people can find you that you'd like?
Yes. If there are, doctors or healthcare professionals or people who are in the field who are interested in my blog, it's called alertandoriented.com. And I blog regularly. Mm-hmm. And with a colleague of mine, we've recently started doing a series of video blogs, and we'll start probably moving to a podcast format as well in the next few weeks, but that will be linked to on my blog, so alertandoriented.com. And the book itself can be found at movingmountainsthebook.com. That's the landing page for the book if people want to find out a little bit more what the book is about.
Great. And it is actually a very fun book to read. You don't have to have much medical knowledge to understand the book. I mean, if you have some, it gives you a little extra insight at points. But, as someone who has been practicing for a while, I was unaware of most of the things that were mentioned in that book. I mean, outside of the way medicine is practiced, but certainly the history. And it's a fun sort of walk through and imagine what it's like if you hung out with Socrates for a while. So.
My interest was actually trying to attack the population health movement at its scientific base, or, the scientific claims that they're making. So I wanted to get to the bottom of it.
Right.
But you're right. I tried to make it, to keep it accessible, and the whole book is in a dialogue format.
It's a quick read too. I mean, I think it's 100 and some pages, but it's a very fast read. You can read all of it within a couple hours, I think. So again, I would highly recommend the book. Dr. Michelle Akkad, thank you so much for spending the afternoon or evening with me, I guess. Depends where you are which coast. And hope to talk to you soon.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.
I get my goals once a week, and it's tough for me to schedule an hour a week. You'd think that would be simple, but kids and trying to get other doctors
to
match it. it's been fun. The nice thing is, you direct primary care guys, you're a lot easier. You kind of have a nice schedule. They're like, oh yeah, I'll just mark off an hour. We'll just talk.
Right.
Like, what? You can do that? Like, yeah, whatever.
Right.
Great. Do you have much of I didn't even ask you, do you have much staff at your practice?
One person, one full time. And she's my secretary. And she's very good. She's a mature person. And she's not a medical trained person, which I wanted. I wanted somebody who could speak to patients and as a person, mm-hmm. and not somebody trained as a medical assistant who's used to, to the assembly line approach. And then I have an ultrasound tech who comes on an as-needed basis. Yeah. So she comes whenever I need to do an echo.
I was trying to figure out how you did echoes by yourself, but moving all those knobs and stuff and taking pictures.
Right. Some cardiologists know how to do that. I'm pretty pitiful, and we're always better off with a with a technician. And she's very good, and she comes once a week or whenever it's needed.